Welcome to The Word for Today, featuring the Bible teaching of Pastor Chuck Smith, founder of the Calvary Chapel Movement. This radio program is a verse-by-verse study through the entire Bible.
And on today's edition of The Word for Today, Pastor Chuck continues with the Dead Sea healed, as we pick up in Ezekiel, chapter 47, verse 1. And now with today's message, here's Pastor Chuck.
Now in chapter 47, we find this river that comes forth from this east gate. Afterward, he brought me again unto the door of the house, and behold, the waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward. For the forefront of the house stood toward the east, and the waters came down from under the right side of the house at the south side of the altar. Now, here from the house of God, this temple house, a spring of water bubbles out and begins to flow toward the east. This is also described in, or spoken of in Zechariah, and it certainly has its counterpart in Revelation chapter 22, that stream in heaven, of which many of the aspects of this are similar to the one there. Now it comes out from the throne there of the temple, from the south part of the east side, and he took him out the north gate because the east gate was only for the prince, and he measured 1,000 cubits, and he brought me through the water, and it was ankle deep. So he measured 1,000, and he brought me through the water, and the water was up to my knees. And again he measured 1,000 cubits, and he brought me through the waters, and they were to my loins. And after he measured 1,000, it was a river that I could not pass over, for the waters were so high, they were waters to swim in, a river that you could not just walk across. So here is an interesting thing. This river that begins here at the temple and begins to flow eastward from the temple towards the Jordan Valley. It increases as it goes. So at 1,000 cubit or 200 or 2,000 feet away, approximately, it's only ankle deep. By the time you get almost 2/3 of a mile away, 3/4 of a mile away, it's knee deep. You go another 2,000 feet and it's waist deep. Go another 1,000 feet and it's over your head. And so this great river coming forth from the area of Jerusalem, originating there at the temple, but yet picking up from other sources, begins to flow probably through the valley that is created when the Mount of Olives splits in the middle and flows on down to the Jordan Plain. And he said to me, "Son of man, did you see that?" And then he brought me and caused me to return to the bank of the river. Now when I had returned, behold, the bank of the river, there were very many trees on either side. And he said unto me, "These waters issue out toward the east country. They go down to the desert, and they go into the sea, which being brought forth into the sea, the waters shall be healed. And it shall come to pass that everything that lives, which moves, whithersoever the rivers shall come, shall live, and there shall be a very great multitude of fish, because these waters shall come thither, for they shall be healed, and everything shall live, whether the water comes. And it shall come to pass that the fishers shall stand upon it from En-Gedi even to En-Eglim, and they shall be a place to spread forth the nets. Their fish shall be according to their kinds, all of the kinds of the fish, even as you find in the Mediterranean, just a great variety of fish." So the interesting thing about this new river that will flow into the Dead Sea, originating there at the temple in Jerusalem, will bring a healing to the waters of the Dead Sea, so that the Dead Sea will no longer be a Dead Sea, but the waters will support all kinds of fish, and it'll be a great fishing spa. So you might want to go down there and open up a worm stand or something, and you can be a successful man in the kingdom age. because they'll be fishing all the way from En-Gedi on down to En-Eglim. Now, there are certain portions of the miry areas and the marshes of the Dead Sea that will remain salty. But for the main body of the Dead Sea, the waters will be healed. And on these trees, their fruit shall be for the meat of the people. Their leaf will not fade, neither will the fruit thereof run out or be consumed. It shall bring forth new fruit according to his months, because their waters they issued out of the sanctuary, and the fruit thereof will be for meat, and the leaf thereof for medicine. So these will be very interesting trees that each month will have a different kind of a fruit. They'll bear fruit year-round, which will be a very life-sustaining type of a food. It'll be a very helpful fruit. Sustain your life. Good protein. It'll be for meat. But the leaves will be used for healing, for medicine, for their medicinal value. So these trees. Now, in Revelation, you get the river that flows from the throne of God there. And again, you find the trees on either side bringing forth the fruit. And so there, you know, of course, God is able. You say, well, I don't know of any tree like that. Of course you don't. God hasn't developed it yet. But he will develop it there in the kingdom age. And what's so hard for God? To create an interesting fruit tree that has very nutritious fruit and bears all year long. Man, you'll want some of those in your garden. And the leaves will be good for medicinal purposes. And the same things are described as along this river in heaven that is pure as crystal flowing from the throne of God in heaven. So read this along with Revelation 22, and you'll find the correlations that are there. Now, even as the tabernacle in the wilderness was built as a model in heaven, so this probably, again, is a model of the heavenly things, and this river is more or less a model of that river flowing from the throne of God in heaven described in Revelation 22. Now the Lord gives them the borders of the land from Damascus on the north and down to the south and to the east and so forth. And then the tribes are divided into the land. And the northernmost part of the land is given to the tribe of Dan. South of him would be Asher, and then Naphtali, then Manasseh, then Ephraim, and then Reuben, and then Judah. And then in the area of Judah, of course, you have this area for the priest and the temple and this new holy city that will be created during that period. And then this portion is set aside perpetually for the Lord and for the priest, not to be sold. And then the residue of this acreage in there will be for the prince. And then south from there, you have the tribe of Benjamin, further south, Simeon, and then Issachar, Zebulun, and Gad as you're moving down into the area of the Sinai. So that whole area, of course, will be green and lush and tillable. Then is when the prophecy will be fulfilled. The desert will blossom as a rose. There will be springs in the deserts and streams and dry places and all. And the land restored and the world restored, really, by the power of the Lord. Now, the city is going to have 12 gates, and the gates will be named after the tribes of the children of Israel. So the three gates on the north will be for Reuben, Judah, and Levi. On the east, the gates will be named for Joseph, Benjamin, and Dan. On the south, the gates will be named Simeon, Issachar, and Zebulun. And on the west, Gad, Asher, and Naphtali. And it was round about 18,000 measures. And the name of the city from that day shall be Jehovah Shama. The Lord is there, the city of the Lord. And thus it gets that beautiful name, Jehovah Shama, The Lord is there. So, as I have shared with you, I'm glad we're through with this portion of Ezekiel. I do not again pretend to have a thorough, full understanding of these things. In this area, I know in part and I prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part will be done away with. But until the Lord brings us a more complete understanding, and I don't see why he needs to at this time. Why should he give me a clear understanding of this now? When it's really for Israel, not for me anyhow. And the time isn't yet. It is yet a future time in the kingdom age. It isn't necessary that I understand this part of it fully right now. I'm sure that one day I will. When I see the whole thing, I walk through the city and I walk through the gates and all, and I look over the whole thing, I say, wow, yeah, well, I'll go back to Ezekiel now. Man, it wasn't bad what the guy did. You know, it's pretty good for a description of it, and I'll understand it more fully then, though right now I'm still sort of foggy on the whole thing. But when we get into Daniel, then we'll cook. Because Daniel speaks of the things that we are seeing coming to pass now in the world around us. And God has given to us a better understanding because these are the things that relate to us and to our times when we get into Daniel. Up until through chapter 39, they related to us in our times. Can see those clearly. But then as we get into the future, it isn't time yet that we should know these things, and thus God hasn't revealed them. That's why you hear people who are seeking to argue against the pre-tribulation rapture theory. They say it is not a theory that was a part of the historic church doctrine. It's something that has come along more recently. And because it was not taught in historic church doctrine, they sort of reject it as having any true authority. But to me, that is not a substantial argument at all. For there are, first of all, things that have been taught in historic church doctrine that I disagree with entirely. Origen taught baptismal regeneration. Origen taught the baptism of infants. I don't think the Bible teaches either. But it was a part and is a part of historic church doctrine. Therefore, there is historic church doctrine which isn't biblical. Secondly, why should God reveal the things of the rapture of the church to Martin Luther when it wasn't going to happen in his time? Even as we don't understand fully these things in Ezekiel because they're not for our time. And it isn't necessary that God make them clear to us because they are things for a yet future time for a different people. So, because the rapture is for our time, even as God told Daniel when he was seeking understanding of the prophecies that he was writing, the Lord said, seal them up, they're for the time of the end. For at that time, knowledge will be increased. In Psalm, when it was writing concerning the future, he said, and the regathering of Israel and all, he said, these things are written for a generation to come. I'm not writing you these things for those that are living now. These are written for a generation to come. So God has written things that are especially for us, and now that we are living in that day, there is a clear understanding. And though the rapture of the church might not be a part of historic church doctrine, it was sure a part of Paul's theology, and when does church history begin? Paul surely taught it, but that it was lost during the history of the church, it must also be confessed that many other beautiful and glorious truths were lost during the history of the church. And really, the church went through the Dark Ages and was actually a part of the cause of the Dark Ages. for the church was guilty, the historic church was guilty of suppressing scientific knowledge and understanding because they were discovering things that were contrary to historic church doctrine when they began to gaze through telescopes and discovered things about our universe that were contrary to historic church doctrine. The history of the church is not a glorious... I think, you know, Stephen was talking to the Sanhedrin and he rehearsed for them their history. Now, these people were always boasting in their fathers. Well, our fathers this, our fathers that, you know. And our fathers, our ancestors. And they were always boasting this stuff. And Stephen, man, he laid them low. He gave them their history. And then he said, which of the prophets did your fathers not stone? And he told them how horrible their fathers were. Your history's pretty black, men. It's pretty dark. Well, let me say that I feel the history of the church is very dark indeed. I have no defense for the history of the church. I'm ashamed of it. So anybody comes to me and starts talking about historic church doctrine, I'm embarrassed over what the church has done in its history. Surely it hasn't been a true representative of Jesus Christ in the world, or there would be more people converted today. The church has been a great stumbling block, and it has hindered progress and development, and it has suppressed men and peoples. I'm ashamed of church history. I don't try to defend it at all. I apologize for it. But I don't have to make the same mistakes, nor am I responsible for the mistakes that they made. Now, a lot of you kids in college, you have a problem because the professors start bringing up things which have happened in church history. They start telling about the wars and how the church has slaughtered so many people and the horrible atrocities that have been done in the name of Christ. And you're defenseless. And I found myself in university defenseless against these things. Now, I used to sort of hang my head. Until the Lord caused me to realize, hey, that's not me and that's not my understanding of Christianity. To me, that isn't a true representative of Christianity. And I began to speak up and say, wait a minute, that's not really Christian. Just because they said they were Christians, just because they went by the church, doesn't mean that they were truly Christians. You get a bunch of grape nuts. It's not grapes, it's not nuts. You don't know what it is. I don't have to answer for the mistakes of the church fathers. I'll have to answer for my own mistakes. And thus, I need to be seeking the guidance of the Spirit that I don't make mistakes, you see. For I'm going to answer for me. But that puts a greater responsibility upon me. Because it is important that I seek God and I seek to live after the biblical injunctions, that I seek to walk after the Spirit, that I seek to be led by the Spirit, that I seek to love as Christ loved and show a better example of what the Lord intended His children to be and to do. Now, even as people have judged the church by the mistakes of the past, so they are continuing to judge the church, but you can help rectify it by living as God would have you to live and be a good example so that they can point to you and say, well, yes, but there's a real Christian. You know, it's interesting when we go to Israel. We'll be talking with a group of the Jewish people over there, and they'll start saying, well, the church this, the church that, and the Christians, oh, the Christians are this, they're that, and the other. And we say, wait a minute, we're Christians. You know, you're talking about Christians, and here we are. We're Christians. What do you mean? Oh, no, you're not Christians. You're Calvary Chapel. You're different. And it's interesting, they recognize a difference. All over, they recognize a difference. They say, you're different. They really don't know where to put us yet. They really don't understand us yet. We come on with so much love and so much concern and interest and all for them. We're just an enigma to them at the present time. I can hardly wait till we get these pastors all over there spreading love all over Israel to these people. But you are the Bible that is being read by the world today. And the opinion of Christianity is being created by what you are. Jesus said, "Let your light so shine before men that when they see your good works, they will glorify your Father, which is in heaven." God help us that we will not be of those of which people say, "Well, if that's a Christian, I don't need any of that." But God help us to live in such a way as the salt of the earth will create a thirst in people for Jesus Christ.
We'll return with more of our verse-by-verse Bible study in the book of Daniel on our next broadcast, as Pastor Chuck continues to teach through the Bible. And we do hope you'll make plans to join us. But right now, if you'd like to order a copy of today's message, simply order Ezekiel 47 through 48 when visiting thewordfortoday.org. And while you're there, be sure to browse the many additional biblical resources by Pastor Chuck. You can also subscribe to the Word for Today podcast or sign up for our email subscription. Once again, that's thewordfortoday.org. For those of you wishing to call, our toll-free number is 1-800-272-WORD, and our office hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Pacific Time. Again, that's 1-800-272-9673. If you prefer to write, our mailing address is The Word for Today, P.O. Box 8000, Costa Mesa, California, 92628. And now, on behalf of The Word for Today, we'd like to thank all of you who share in supporting this ministry with your prayers and financial support. And be sure to join us again next time as Pastor Chuck continues his verse-by-verse study through the Bible. That's right here on the next edition of The Word for Today. And now, once again, here's Pastor Chuck.
God bless you. God keep you. Fill you with His Spirit and with His love. Watch over you. That we might each of us grow into a greater apprehension of all that God is and desires to do for us. And may above all you walk in love. Jesus' name.
This program has been sponsored by Calvary Chapel of Costa Mesa, California.
I have a question for you. How would you like to go from Genesis to Revelation in 1 year using a daily Bible devotional? And what if this devotional was written by Pastor Chuck? Then I've got great news. Be one of the many thousands of readers who have enjoyed reading Wisdom for Today, a daily devotional that speaks volumes of wisdom to apply to your everyday life. Come alongside Pastor Chuck as he takes you on a journey from Genesis to Revelation, providing God's truth to answer your questions and discover how this might very well become your most beloved and cherished devotional ever. To order your copy of Wisdom for Today, a leather hardback, for yourself or for a loved one, please call The Word for Today at 1-800-272-9673. Or visit us online for more information and to read a preview at thewordfortoday.org.